door, he noticed for the first time, was a crate the size of a sideboard. "She did it," he thought, as he leaned closer to read the writing on the outside. "A Grundig, no less. The best money can buy." His own gramophone and radio had conked out a few months before. Periodically, he would glance at the child, make sure the little chest was moving. After what felt like half an hour, he yawned, looked at his watch, and was astonished to find that only 7 minutes had passed. "My God, this is going to be difficult," he thought. He finished his cup of coffee and poured a second. He stood and circled the room. On one shelf was a bound set of books. Great World Classics series was stamped in a gold imprint. He picked one volume and sat down. The book was beautifully bound in a leathery cover and had gold-trimmed pages that looked as if they had never been opened. At 4 in the morning, he went to wake Hema. In sleep, she looked like a little girl, both hands together and tucked under one cheek. He gently shook her, and she opened her eyes, saw him, and smiled. He held out the cup of coffee. "My turn?" He nodded. She sat up. "Did he stop breathing?"
"Twice. There was no doubt about it."
"God, oh God! I wasn't imagining it, was I? We're so lucky I saw that first one."
"Drink this, then wash your face and come to the bedroom." When she returned, he gave her the thread running to the anklet, the notebook with the pen clipped to it. "Whatever you do, don't lie on the bed. Stay in this chair. It's the only way to stay awake. I've been reading, which really helps. I look up at the end of every page. If I hear the anklet move, then I don't look up and I keep reading. When he stopped breathing, I tugged at the anklet and he started right back up. Little fellow just forgets to breathe."
"Why should he have to remember? Poor baby."
Hema had hardly settled in the chair when she heard a strange noise. It took her a second to realize that it was the sound of Ghosh snoring. She tiptoed to where he was on the sofa, dead to the world, looking like a big teddy bear. She covered him with the blanket which had slipped to the floor, and she returned to her vigil. The snoring reassured her. It told her she was not alone. She picked up the book Ghosh had been reading. She bought the set of 12 books from a staffer at the British Embassy who was returning home. She was ashamed not to have read even one. Ghosh had put a bookmark on page 92.
Had he really come that far? Why did he pick this book?
She turned to the first page.
"Who that cares much to know the history of man, and how the mysterious mixture behaves under the varying experiments of time, has not dwelt, at least briefly, on the life of Saint Teresa, has not smiled with some gentleness at the thought of the little girl walking forth one morning hand in hand with her still smaller brother to go and seek martyrdom in the country of the Moors."
She read that opening sentence 3 times before she understood what it might be about. She looked at the title of the book, Middlemarch.
Why couldn't the writer be clear?
She read on, only because Ghosh had managed to keep reading. Little by little, she found herself immersed in the story. The next morning, as Ghosh made rounds, he wondered if the colonel made it back to his garrison in Gondar without incident. If the colonel had been arrested or hanged, would news ever reach missing? The Ethiopian Herald never wrote about treason, as if it were treasonable to report treason. After looking in on his patients, Ghosh unearthed an incubator from one of the storage sheds behind Matron's bungalow. Ghosh was Missing's de facto pediatrician. In the early years, he'd fashioned an incubator for premature babies. After the Swedish government opened a pediatric hospital in Addis Ababa, Missing sent all the very premature babies there and put the incubator away. Despite its delicate construction with glass on 4 sides and a tin base, the incubator was still intact. He had Gebru hose it off, dust it for fleas, put it in the sunlight for a few hours, then rinse it again with hot water. Gosh wiped it down with alcohol before setting it up in Hamer's bedroom. No sooner had he stepped back to admire it than Almaz walked around it three times, making two-two sounds, stopping short of actually spitting.
"To ward off the evil eye,"
she explained in Amharic, wiping her lip with the back of her forearm.
"Remind me never to invite you into the operating theater," Gosh said in English. "Hema," he said, hoping she would weigh in. "Antisepsis? Lister? Pasteur? Are you no longer a believer?"
"You forget I am postpartum, man," she said. "Warding off spirits is much more important."
The twins lay swaddled next to each other like larvae, sharing the incubator, their skulls covered with monkey caps and only their wizened newborn faces showing. No matter how far apart Hema put them, when she came to them again, they would be in a V, their heads touching, facing each other, just as they had been in the womb. Some nights, as he took his shift by the sleeping infant, exhausted, fighting sleep, he talked to himself.
"Why are you here? Would she do this for you?"
The old resentments made his jaw tighten.
"You silly bugger. You allowed yourself to succumb to a spell again?"
Why did he lack the willpower to say what must be said? He told himself that once the infant, this Shiva, was over its breathing problem, he would leave. Knowing Hema, when she no longer had to rely on him, things would be back to where they had always been. Since Harris's visit, it was unclear if the Houston Baptists would continue their support. Matron wouldn't give her opinion. For 2 weeks, he and Hema kept a vigil over Shiva, getting help in the daytime but reserving the night for themselves. They had finished Middlemarch in a week, and it had given them plenty to discuss. He picked Zola's Three Cities trilogy, Paris, next, and that they both found absorbing. Shiva's episodes of apnea decreased from more than 20 a day to 2 a day, and then ceased. They extended their vigil into a third week, just to be on the safe side. Hema's sofa was too small for a man of Gosh's proportions, and seeing him scrunched up there, she felt grateful to him and conscious of his sacrifice. It would have surprised her to know how much he relished occupying the space that she just vacated, and covering himself with a blanket still scented with her dreams. The jingling of Shiva's ankle bracelet filtered into his sleep, and one night he dreamed that Hema was dancing for him, naked. It was so vivid, so real, that the next morning he hurried to Cook's Travel, waited till they opened, and cancelled his ticket to America. He did it before he had any coffee, or a chance to second-guess himself. Matron was increasingly stooped, her face more weathered in the aftermath of Sister Mary Joseph Braze's death. She spent her evenings at Hema's, everybody did, but she didn't protest when Gosh and Hema sent her back to her quarters by 8, accompanied by Cthulhu. That dog had become protective of Matron, and since the other two nameless dogs often followed Cthulhu, Matron had an entourage with her. 2 weeks after they buried Sister, Gebru saw a barefoot coolie walk with his right arm in a long cast, the elbow straight at his side. Worse still, the man was so sleepy he staggered and was in danger of breaking his head, not to mention his other arm. Gebru felt terrible because it was he who had directed the coolie to the Russian hospital when he showed up at Missing with a fracture. The Russian doctors loved injecting barbiturates no matter what ailed you, and since their patients loved the needle, no one left the Russian hospital unsedated. Gebru knew from his years at Missing that a broken forearm had to be cast in a neutral and functional position, with the elbow flexed to 90 degrees, the forearm midway between pronation and supination, even though he knew none of those terms.
He escorted the unsteady coolie to the casualty room where, after Ghosh looked at the X-ray, the orderlies reapplied the cast. At that moment, though none of them quite realized it, Missing officially reopened for business. Hema refused to leave the infants. She claimed she was no longer a doctor, but a mother. She was the kind of mother who was fearful for her children, who loved being with them, and was unwilling to part from them. The two Mamitus, Stone's Rosina and Ghosh's Almaz, took turns sleeping on a mattress in her kitchen and were ready to help. With Stone gone or dead, and Hema a full-time mother, once the gates opened, the burden on Ghosh was huge. Matron hired Bocelli to run the morning outpatient clinics where the great majority of Missing's patients were seen. This allowed Ghosh the freedom to operate when he could, and to concentrate on the patients admitted to the hospital. 6 weeks after Sister Mary Joseph Braze's death, the gravestone arrived, hauled up by donkey cart. Hema and Ghosh went to see it levered into place. The mason had carved a Coptic cross on the stone. Below it, he had etched letters he copied from the paper matron had given him. Sister Mary Joseph Braze, born 1928, died 1954, safe in arms of Jesus. Matron arrived, short of breath and agitated. The three of them stood there, studying the strange lettering. The mason looked on, hoping for a commendation. Matron let out a sigh of exasperation.
"I don't suppose he can do much about that now," Matron said, and gave the man a nod.
He gathered his crowbars and gunny sacks and led his animal away.
"I was thinking," Hema said, her voice hoarse, "that inscription should read, 'Died at the hands of a surgeon, now safe in the arms of Jesus.'"
"Hema," Matron protested, "custody of the tongue."
"No, really," Hema said. "A rich man's faults are covered with money, but a surgeon's faults are covered with earth. Sister Mary Joseph Praise is covered in the soil of the land she came to love," Matron said, hoping to put a stop to this kind of talk.
"Put there by a surgeon,"
said Hema, who had to have the last word.
"Who has now left the country," Matron said.
They turned to look at her, mouths open. Matron said apologetically,
"I got a call from the British consulate. That's why I was late. From what I can piece together, Stone went to the Kenyan border, then to Nairobi, don't ask me how. He's in bad shape. Drink, I presume. The man was crazed."
"He's not hurt or anything?" Ghosh said.
"As best as I can tell, he's in one piece. I made a trunk call to Mr. Elihu Harris just now. Yes, I got Harris involved. They have a big mission in Kenya. If he sobers up, Harris thinks Stone could work there. Or if he doesn't want that, Eli can arrange for him to go to America."
"But what about his books and his things?" Ghosh said. "Should we send them on to him?"
"I imagine he'll write for his books and specimens once he's settled," Matron said.
The news both annoyed and pleased Hema. It meant Stone had abandoned the children, and that he'd given up any claims on them. She wished he'd signed a paper to that effect. She still felt uneasy. A man who made his name at Missing, whose lover was buried at Missing, and whose children were being raised at Missing, might not be able to cut the Missing cord that easily.
"The crookedness of the serpent is still straight enough to slide through the snake hole," Hema said.
"He's no serpent,"
Ghosh said sharply, contradicting Hema. She was too astonished to reply.
"He is my friend,"
Ghosh continued in a tone that dared anyone to disagree.
"Let's not forget what a valuable colleague he was all these years, the great service he gave to Missing, the lives he saved. He's no serpent."
He spun on his heels and walked off. Ghosh's words pricked Hema's conscience.
She couldn't assume that he was to feel everything she felt, not if she cared for him. Ghosh was his own man, had been all along. She gazed at Ghosh's receding back and was frightened. She'd never worried particularly about Ghosh's feelings, but now, at the graveside, she felt like a young girl who, while drawing water at the well, meets a handsome stranger, a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity, but she ruins it by saying the wrong thing. Chapter 16. Bride for a Year. The milk cow was Hema's folly, but once the first cream-rich mouthful slid down her throat, there was no going back, even if Ghosh had taken away the reason for a cow.
"Are you joking, Hema? You can't give cow's milk to newborn babies."
"Who says so?"
she said, but without conviction.
"I do," he said. "Besides, they've been thriving on formula for weeks. They are staying on formula."
After his sharp words at sister's graveside, she'd felt a terrible premonition that he would leave missing. But in the ensuing days, he had proved true to her, returning to sleep on the sofa. The calm, methodical way he'd approached Shiva's problem was a side of him she hadn't appreciated. On the wall by the door, he taped a paper that graphed the waning and disappearance of those terrifying episodes of apnea. Hema would never have had the confidence to say what he said one evening, that the night watch was over.
He'd been sleeping on the sofa since the day she summoned him, and now she didn't want him to leave.
His snoring was a sound she'd come to depend on. But she couldn't resist arguing with him now and then. It was an old reflex. She thought of it as her way of being affectionate. They didn't take the anklet off Shiva's foot, even though it was no longer needed. The sound had become part of Shiva, and to remove it felt akin to taking away his voice. In the early morning, a stone bell heralded the procession of Cow, Calf, and Asrat, the milkman, up the driveway. The cowbell was tonally related to the chime of Shiva's anklet. Asrat charged more for bringing the milk factory to the house, but by milking under Rosina's or Almaz's watchful eye, there was no question of the milk being watered down. By the time Hema rose, the house was suffused with the scent of boiling milk. She took to adding more and more milk to her morning coffee. Soon, when Hema heard the cowbell, her mouth watered, just as if she were one of Professor Pavlov's mutts. Her morning coffee grew to 2 tumblers, and she had another 2 glasses during the day, more milk than coffee, loving the way the buttery flavor lingered on her tongue. Unlike the buffalo milk of her childhood, this milk was made so very tasty by the highland grass on which the cow fed. When Asrat, whose bovine equanimity Hema believed came from having his cows sleep inside his hut at night, said one morning,
"If only madam could buy corn feed, the milk would be so thick a spoon would stand up in it,"
she didn't hesitate. Soon, a coolie arrived with 10 sacks on a handcart stamped Rockefeller Foundation and Not for Resale.
"The best investment I've ever made,"
Hema said a few days later, smacking her lips like a schoolgirl.
"Corn makes all the difference."
"Hardly a controlled experiment, given the bias you introduced by paying for the corn," Ghosh said.
Asrat tethered the animals behind the kitchen, the calf just out of reach of its mother's udders, while he delivered what milk remained to other homes. The cow and calf called to each other with such soothing and auspicious sounds. Hema remembered her mother saying,
"A cow carries the universe in its body, Brahma in the horns, Agni in the brow, Indra in the head."
The calf's call for its mother was nothing like the cry of her twins, but the emotion was identical. In her years as an obstetrician, Hema had never thought too much about a newborn's cry, never paused to consider the frequency that made a baby's tongue and lips quiver like a reed. It was such a helpless, urgent sound, but hitherto its importance lay in what it signaled. A successful labor, a live birth. Only when it was absent was it noteworthy. But now, when her newborns, her Shiva and Marian, cried, it was like no other earthly sound. It summoned her from sleep's catacombs and brought shushing noises to her throat as she rushed to the incubator. It was a personal call. Her babies wanted her. She remembered a phenomenon she'd experienced for years when she was about to fall asleep. A sense that someone was calling her name. Now, she told herself, it had been her unborn twins telling her they were coming. There were other noises she became attuned to in her new mother state. The thwack of wet cloth on the washing stone. The clothesline sagging with diapers, banners to fecundity, and raising a flapping alarm before a rain squall, sending Almaz and Rosina racing outside. The glass harp notes of feeding bottles clinking together in the boiling water. Rosina singing, her constant chatter. Almaz clanging pots and pans. These sounds were the chorale of Hema's contentment. A Maharashtrian astrologer, on a tour of East Africa, came to the house over Ghosh's objections. Hema paid for him to read the children's fortunes. With his spectacles and fountain pens in his shirt pocket, he looked like a young railway clerk. After recording the exact times of the twins' births, he wanted the parents' birth dates. Hema gave hers and then volunteered Ghosh's, throwing Ghosh a warning look. The astrologer consulted his tables, and his calculations filled one side of a foolscap paper. At last he said, "Impossible." He looked nervously at Hema, but avoided Ghosh's eyes. He capped his pen, put away his papers, and while an astonished Hema looked on, he made for the door.
"Whatever is their destiny," he said, "you can be sure it's linked to the father."
Ghosh got up with him at the gate. He declined Ghosh's offer of money. With a mournful expression, he intoned,
"Dr. Saab, I'm afraid you cannot be the father."
Ghosh pretended to be deeply troubled by this news. Ghosh reported back to Hema, but she wasn't half as amused as he was. It left her fearful, as if the man had somehow predicted Thomas Stone's return. The next day, Ghosh found Hema squatting, cupping rice flour in her fist and drawing a rangoli, an elaborate decorative pattern, on the wooden floor just outside her bedroom, taking pains that the lines were uninterrupted so the evil spirits could not pass. Above the doorframe to the bedroom, Hema hung a mask of a bearded devil with bloodshot eyes, his tongue sticking out, a further deflection of the evil eye. It became part of a morning ritual along with the playing of Suprabhatam on the Grundig, a version sung by M.S. Subbalakshmi. The chant's hiccuping syncopation evoked for Ghosh the sound of women sweeping the front yard around the banyan tree in the early mornings in Madras and the dobi ringing his bicycle bell. Subrabhatam was what radio stations used to begin their daily broadcast, and as a student, Ghosh had heard the words of Subrabhatam on the lips of dying patients. It amused him that he had to come to Ethiopia to learn exactly what it was. An invocation and a wake-up call for Lord Venkateshwara. Ghosh noticed that Hema's bedroom closet was now a shrine dominated by the symbol of Shiva, a tall lingam. In addition to the little brass statues of Ganesh, Lakshmi and Muruga, now came a sinister-looking ebony carving of the indecipherable Lord Venkateshwara, as well as a ceramic Immaculate Heart of the Virgin Mary and a ceramic crucified Christ, blood welling out of the nail holes. Ghosh held his tongue. Without fanfare and quite unexpectedly, Ghosh had become missing surgeon. Though he was no Thomas Stone, he had now handled several acute abdomens, his stomach fluttering just like the first time, and dealt with stab wounds and major fractures and even put in a chest tube for trauma. A woman in the labor and delivery room had suddenly developed airway obstruction. Ghosh ran in and cut high in the neck, opening the cricothyroid membrane. The aspirate sound of air rushing in was its own reward, as was the sight of the patient's lips turning from deep blue to pink. Later that day, under better lighting in the operating theater, he did his first thyroidectomy. Operating Theater 3 was now a familiar place, but still fraught with danger. Nothing was routine for him. On the day the twins turned 2 months old, Ghosh was in mid-surgery when the probationer poked her head in to say that Hema urgently needed him. Ghosh was removing a foot so destroyed by chronic infection that it had become a weeping, oozing stump. The boy had traveled alone from his village near Aksum, a voyage of several days, to beg Ghosh to cut off the offending part.
"It has stuck to my body for 3 years," he said, pointing to the foot that was 4 times the size of the other foot and shapeless, with toes barely visible.
Madura foot was found wherever people habitually walked barefoot, but the town of Madurai, not far from Madras, had the dubious honor of lending its name to the disease. No place ever came off well when a disease was named after it. Delhi belly, Baghdad blues, turkey trots. Madura foot began when a field worker stepped on a large thorn or nail. Their livelihood gave them no choice but to keep walking, and slowly a fungus overran the foot, invaded bone, tendon, and muscle. Nothing short of amputation would help. Encouraged by the old surgical saw, any idiot can amputate a leg, Ghosh had decided to proceed. If he hesitated, it was because the rest of the saying went, "But it takes a skilled surgeon to save one." Still, there was no saving this foot. The boy was the first patient Ghosh had ever seen who sang and clapped his way into the theater, overjoyed at having surgery. Ghosh cut through the skin above the ankle, leaving a flap at the back to cover the stump. He tied off the blood vessels and sawed through the bone and heard the thump of the foot landing in the bucket. It was at this point that the probationer delivered her summons. Ghosh covered the wound with a damp, sterile towel, and he ran home, tearing off his mask and cap, imagining the worst. He burst into Hema's bedroom, breathless. "What is it?" Hema, in a silk sari, had spread rice out on the floor. In Sanskrit letters, she'd spelled out the boys' names in the grains. Shiva was in her arms, and Rosina held Marian. Hema had assembled a few Indian women, who were glaring at him in disapproval.
"The post came," Hema said. "We forgot to do the Namakaranam, Ghosh, naming ceremony. Should be on the 11th day, but you can also do it on the 16th day. We have not done it on either of those 2 days, but in my mother's letter, she says as long as I do it, as soon as I get her aerogram, we are all right."
"You made me leave an operation for this?"
He was furious. It was on his lips to say, "How can you subscribe to all this witchcraft?"
"Look,"
Hema hissed, embarrassed by his behavior.
"The father is supposed to whisper the child's name into its ear. If you don't want to do it, I'll call someone else."
That word, father, changed everything. He felt a thrill. He quickly whispered Marian and then Shiva into each tiny ear, kissed each child, then kissed Hema on the cheek before she could pull away, saying, "Bye, Mama," scandalizing Hema's guests before he raced back to the theater to fashion the flap over the stump. The twins weren't easy to tell apart but for the anklet which Hema had kept on Shiva as a talisman. While Shiva was peaceful, quiet,
Mary intended to furrow his eyebrows in concentration when Ghosh carried him, as if trying to reconcile the strange man with the curious sounds he made. Shiva was slightly smaller, and his skull still bore the marks of Stone's attempts at extraction. He fussed only when he heard Marion crying, as if to show solidarity. By 12 weeks, the twins had gained weight. Their cries were lusty, their movements vigorous. They clenched their fists against their chests, and now and then they stretched out their arms and focused on their hands with cross-eyed wonder. If they didn't show awareness of each other, Hema believed it was because they thought they were one. When they were bottle-fed, one in Rosina's arms, the other in Hema's or Ghosh's, it helped greatly for them to be within earshot, heads or limbs touching. If they took one twin to another room, they both became fussy. At 5 months, the boys had a riot of black curly hair. They had Stone's close-set eyes, which made them appear hyper-vigilant, examining their surroundings like clinicians. Their irises, depending on the light, were a very light brown or a dark blue. The forehead, round and generous, and the perfect Cupid's bow of the lip, was all Sister Mary Joseph Bray's. They were, Hema thought, much more beautiful than Glaxo babies. And there were two of them, and they were hers. To his delight, Ghosh had the magic touch when it came to putting them to sleep. He supported one child on each forearm, their cheeks against his shoulder, while their feet rested on the shelf of his belly. He would circumnavigate Hema's living room, bobbing and swaying. For lack of lullabies, he reached into his repertoire of body verse. One night, Matron took Ghosh aside and said, "Your limericks are usurping my prayers." Ghosh pictured Matron on her knees, reciting, "There was a man from Madras, whose balls were made out of brass. In stormy weather, they clanged together, and sparks came out of his arse."
"I'm sorry, Matron."
"It can hardly be good for them to hear these things at such a tender age."
Ghosh could barely remember what his life was like before the twins arrived. When they snuggled in his arms, smiled, or pressed their wet chins against him, he felt his heart would burst with pride. Marion and Shiva. Now he could not imagine any better names. Of late, his shoulders ached and his hands were numb when the Mammothus lifted the sleeping boys from his arms. Since he started sleeping on Hema's sofa, he'd not had a twinge of discomfort when he peed. Hema regained some of her old manner. At times, he missed their sparring. Had he pursued her all these years precisely because she was so unattainable? What if she had agreed to marry him as soon as he arrived in Ethiopia? Would his passion have survived? Everyone needed an obsession, and in the last 8 years, she'd given him his, and for that, perhaps he should be grateful. Many a night, after putting the boys to bed, he had to return to finish up at the hospital. Not one drop of beer had touched his lips since his first night on Hema's sofa. On Hema's narrow couch, he slept peacefully and woke refreshed. Living under the same roof, Ghosh discovered that Hema chewed khat. It began during the night vigils with Shiva, and it had helped her through her shift. Her bookmark was soon ahead of his in Middlemarch, and she was on Zola before he was done. She tried to hide the cart from him, and when he mentioned it, he found it touching how flustered she became.
"I don't know what you are talking about," she said.
So he didn't bring it up again, though he knew when he saw her knitting late into the night, or when she waited up for him and was chattier than Rosina, that she had probably had a little chew before he arrived. Adid, the always smiling merchant she had seen on the plane coming back from Aden, and whose company they both enjoyed, brought her the leaves. As for Ghosh, Proximity to Hema was his drug. He brushed against her when he lowered the sleeping babies into the crib that replaced the incubator. He was encouraged when she didn't turn around and snap at him. He gazed at her while sipping his morning coffee as she wrote out shopping lists for him, or consulted with Almaz about the plans for the day. One day, she saw him looking.
What? I look horrible first thing in the morning, is that it?
No. You look the opposite of horrible. She blushed.
Shut up,
she said. But the glow in her face did not fade. One evening at dinner, he said, more to himself than to her, I wonder what has become of Thomas Stone. Hema pushed her chair back and stood up.
Please, I don't want you to ever mention that man's name in this house.
There were tears in her eyes, and fear. He went to her. He could bear her anger, he could suffer it, but he couldn't bear to see her in distress. He grabbed her hands, pulled her toward him. She fought but finally gave in as he murmured, It's all right. I didn't mean to upset you. It's all right. I'd sell my best friend down the river to be able to hold you like this.
What if he comes and claims them? You heard the astrologer?
She was trembling.
Have you thought about that?
He won't, Ghosh said. But she heard the uncertainty in his voice. She marched to her bedroom.
Well, if he tries, it will be over my dead body. Do you hear me? Over my dead body!
One very cold night, when the twins were 9 months old, and while the Mamitus slept in their quarters, and when Matron had returned to hers, everything changed. There was no longer a reason for Ghosh to sleep on the couch, but neither of them had brought up the idea of his leaving. Ghosh came in just before midnight, and he found Hema sitting at the dining table. He came up close to her so she could inspect his eyes and see if there was liquor on his breath. It was what he always did to tease her when he returned at this hour. She pushed him away. He went in to look at the twins. When he came out, he said, I smell incense. He'd scolded her before for letting the twins breathe in any smoke.
It's a hallucination. Maybe the gods are trying to reach you.
She pretended to be absorbed in the task of putting his dinner on the table.
Macaroni that Rosina prepared, she said, uncovering a bowl. And Almaz left chicken curry for you. They are competing to feed you. God knows why.
Ghosh tucked his napkin into his shirt.
You call me godless? If you read your Vedas or your Gita, you'll remember a man went to the sage Ramakrishna saying, O Master, I don't know how to love God.
Hema frowned.
And the sage asked him if there was anything he loved. He said, I love my little son. And Ramakrishna said, There is your love and service to God. In your love and service to that child.
So where were you at this hour, Mr. Godly Man?
Doing a cesarean section. I was in and out in 15 minutes, Ghosh said.
Hema did 3 cesarean sections in the weeks after the birth of the twins. Once to teach Ghosh, once to assist him as he did it, and the third time to stand by and watch. No woman would die at missing or be sent elsewhere for want of a C-section.
The baby had the cord wrapped around its neck. Baby is fine. The mother is already asking for her boiled egg.
Watching Ghosh eat had become Hema's nightly pastime. His appetites engaged him. He lived in the center of a flurry of ideas and projects that made piles around her sofa. Her mind had been drifting, so she had to ask him to repeat what he said.
I said I would be in the middle of my internship at Cook County Hospital now, had I gone. I was ready to leave Ethiopia, you know.
Why? Because Stone left?
No, woman, before that. Before the babies were born or sister died.
You see, I was convinced that you would come back from India a married woman.
To Hema, this was so absurd, so unexpected, a reminder of an innocent time from so long ago that she burst out laughing. Ghosh's consternation made it even funnier, and the safety pin that held the top of her blouse together flew into the air and landed in his plate. That was too much for her, and she clutched her breast and rose from her chair, doubled over. Since her return from India and the tragedy of sister's death, there had been few occasions for side-splitting humor. When she caught her breath, she said,
"That's what I like about you, Ghosh. I'd forgotten. You can make me laugh like no one else on earth."
She sat back in her chair. Ghosh had stopped eating. He pushed the plate away. He was clearly upset, and she didn't know why. He wiped his lips with the napkin, his movements precise and deliberate. There was a quaver in his voice.
"What joke?" he said again. "My wanting to marry you all these years was a joke?"
She found it difficult to meet his gaze. She'd never told him what had gone through her mind when she thought her plane was crashing, and how her last earthly thought was about him. The smile on her face felt false, and she couldn't sustain it. She looked away, but her eye caught the menacing mask nailed up over the bedroom door. Ghosh dropped his head into his hands. His mood had turned from ebullient to despairing. She had pushed him past a breaking point. And all because she had laughed? Once again she felt uncertain around him, as she had that day at Sister Mary Joseph Braze's grave.
"It's time I moved back to my quarters," he said.
"No!"
Hema said, so forcefully that they were both startled. She pulled her chair closer to his. She peeled his hands from his head and held them. She studied the strange profile of her colleague, her unhandsome but beautiful friend of so many years, who had allowed his fate to become so inextricably tangled with hers. He seemed intent on leaving. He wasn't looking to her for guidance. She kissed his hand. He resisted. She moved even closer. She pulled his head to her bosom, which, without the safety pin, was more exposed than it had ever been in front of a man. She held him the way he had held her when he came running the night Shiva stopped breathing. After a while, she turned his face to hers. And before she could think about what she was doing, or why, and how this had happened, she kissed him, finding pleasure in the way his lips felt on hers. She saw now and was ashamed to see how selfishly she had dealt with him, made use of him all these years. She'd not done it consciously. Nevertheless, she treated him as if he'd existed for her pleasure. It was her turn to sigh, and she led the stunned Ghosh to the second bedroom, which was used to iron clothes and as storage, a bedroom she should have given him long ago instead of leaving him on the sofa. They undressed in the dark, cleared the bed of the mountain of diapers, towels, saris, and other garments. They resumed their embrace under the covers.
"Hema, what if you get pregnant?" he asked.
"Ah, you don't understand," she said. "I'm 30. I may have left it too late already."
To his shame, now that those magnificent orbs he had fantasized about were unfettered and in his hands, now that she was his from the fleshy chin pad to the dimples above her buttocks, the transformation of his member from floppy flesh to stiff bamboo did not happen. When Hema realized what was amiss, she said nothing. Her silence only increased his distress. Ghosh didn't know that Hema blamed herself, that she thought she had been over-eager and that she had misread the signs and misunderstood the man. A hyena's coughing in the distance seemed to mock them both. She stayed perfectly still, as if lying on a landmine. At some point, she fell asleep. She awoke to a sensation of rising from underwater to being resurrected and reclaimed. And it was because Ghosh's mouth was around her left breast, trying to swallow it. He directed her movements, pushing her this way and that. And it made her think that even when he had been at his most passive, he had really been in charge. The sight of his great block of a head and his lips resting where no man had been before brought forth a rush of blood to her cheeks, her chest, and deep in her pelvis. One of his hands held her other breast, shockwaves surging through her, while his other hand caressed her inner thighs. She found her hands responding in kind, pulling his head to her, reaching for his broad back, wanting him to swallow her whole. And now she felt something unmistakable and promising against her thighs. In that moment, witnessing his animal eagerness, she understood that she'd forever lost him as a plaything, as a companion. He was no longer the Ghosh she toyed with, the Ghosh who existed only as a reaction to her own existence. She felt ashamed for not having seen him this way before, ashamed for presuming to know the nature of this pleasure and thereby denying herself and denying him all these years. She pulled him in, welcomed him, colleague, fellow physician, stranger, friend, and lover. She gasped in regret for all the evenings they'd sat across from each other, baiting each other and throwing barbs, though, now that she thought about it, she did most of the baiting and throwing, when they could have been engaged in this astonishing congress. In the early morning, she awoke, fed and changed the children, and when they went back to sleep, she returned to Ghosh. They began again, and it was as if it were the first time, the sensations unique and unimaginable, the headboards slapping against the wall, advertising their passion to Almaz and Rosina, who were just arriving in the kitchen, but she didn't care. They slept, and only when they heard the cowbell and the calf cry did they rise. Ghosh stopped Hema as she was about to leave the room.
"Is marrying me still a laughing matter?"
"What are you saying?"
"Hema, will you marry me?"
He was unprepared for her response, and later he wondered how she could have been so ready with an answer, one that would never have occurred to him.
"Yes, but only for a year."
"What?"
"Face it, this situation with the children threw us together. I don't want you to feel obliged. I will marry you for a year, and then we are done."
"But that is absurd," Ghosh sputtered.
"We have the option to renew for another year, or not."
"I know what I want, Hema. I want this forever. I have always wanted it, forever and ever. I know that at the end of the year I will want to renew."
"Well, you may know, my sweet man, but what if I don't? Now, you have surgery scheduled this morning, no? Well, you can tell Matron that I'll start doing hysterectomies and other elective surgery again. And it's time you learn some gynecologic surgery, something other than just C-sections."
She glanced at him over her shoulder as she departed. And the coyness in her smile and the mischief in her eyes and her arched eyebrows and the steep tilt of her neck were those of a dancer sending a signal without words. Her message silenced him. Instead of a year or a lifetime, suddenly he could only think of nightfall, and though it was only 12 hours away, it felt like an eternity.
Part 3. "I will not cut for stone, even for patients in whom the disease is manifest. I will leave this operation to be performed by practitioners, specialists in this art."
Hippocratic oath.
"Theirs is the stoneless fruit of love, whose love is returned."
Tiruvalluvar, the Kural.
Chapter 17. Tizita.
I remember the early mornings, sweeping into the kitchen in Ghosh's arms. He is counting under his breath. 1, 2, 1, 2, 3. We twirl, dip, lunge. For the longest time, I will think that dancing is his occupation. We execute a turn before the stove and arrive at the rear door, where Ghosh works the lock and shoots back the bolt with a flourish. Almaz and Rosina step in, quickly shutting the door against the cold and against Cuchulu, who is wagging her tail, awaiting breakfast. Both Mamitus are wrapped like mummies, only their eyes showing in a crescent gap. They peel off layers, and the odors of cut grass and then turned earth, then berbere and coal fires rise from them like steam. I laugh uncontrollably in anticipation, tuck my chin into my body, because I know Rosina's fingers, which are like icicles, will soon stroke my cheek. The first time she did this, I was startled into laughter instead of tears, a mistake because it has encouraged this ritual that I dread and anticipate every day. After breakfast, Hema and Ghosh kiss Shiva and me goodbye. Tears, despair, clinging. But they leave anyway, off to the hospital. Rosina places us in the double pram. Soon, with uplifted hands, I beg to be carried. I want higher ground. I want the adult view. She gives in. Shiva is content wherever he is placed, as long as no one tries to remove his anklet. Rosina's forehead is a ball of chocolate. Her braided hair marches back in neat rows, then flies out in a fringe that reaches her shoulders. She is a bouncing, rocking, and humming being. Her twirls and turns are faster than Ghosh's. From my dizzy perch, her pleated dress makes gorgeous florets, and her pink plastic shoes flash in and out of sight. Rosina talks non-stop. We are silent, speechless, but full of thoughts, impressions, all of them unspoken. Rosina's Amharic makes Almaz and Gibru laugh because her guttural, throat-clearing syllables don't really exist in Amharic. It never dissuades her. Sometimes she breaks into Italian, particularly when she is being forceful, struggling to make a point. Italinya comes easily to her, and strangely its meaning is clear, even though no one else speaks it. Such is the nature of that language. When she speaks to herself or sings, it is in her Eritrean tongue, Tigrinya, and then her voice is unlocked, the words pouring out. Almaz, who once served Ghosh in his quarters, is now the cook in his and Hema's joint household. She stands rooted like a baobab to her spot in front of the stove, a giantess compared with Rosina, and not given to sound other than the deep sonorous sighs or an occasional iwanut, you don't say, to keep Rosina or Gibru's chatter going, not that either of them needs encouragement. Almaz is fairer than Rosina, and her hair is contained by a gauzy orange sash that forms a Phrygian helmet. While Rosina's teeth shine like headlights, Almaz rarely shows hers. By mid-morning, when we return from our first bungalow to casualty to woman's ward to front gate excursion, with Cuchulu as our bodyguard, the kitchen is alive. Steam rises in plumes as Almaz clangs lids on and off the pots. The silver weight on the pressure cooker jiggles and whistles. Almaz's sure hands chop onions, tomatoes and fresh coriander, making hillocks that dwarf the tiny mounds of ginger and garlic. She keeps a palette of spices nearby. Curry leaves, turmeric, dry coriander, cloves, cinnamon, mustard seed, chili powder, all in tiny stainless steel bowls within a large mother platter. A mad alchemist, she throws a pinch of this, a fistful of that, then wets her fingers and flings that moisture into the mortar. She pounds with the pestle. The wet, crunchy thunk, thunk soon changes to the sound of stone on stone. Mustard seeds explode in the hot oil. She holds a lid over the pan to fend off the missiles. Rat-a-tat, like hail on a tin roof. She adds the cumin seeds, which sizzle, darken, and crackle. A dry, fragrant smoke chases out the mustard scent. Only then are the onions added, handfuls of them, and now the sound is that of life being spawned in a primordial fire. Rosina abruptly hands me to Almaz and hurries out the back door, her legs crossing like scissor blades. We don't know this, but Rosina is carrying the seed of revolution. She is pregnant with a baby girl, Genet. The three of us, Shiva, Genet, and me, are together from the start, she in utero, while Shiva and I negotiate the world outside. The handoff to Almaz is unexpected. I whimper on Almaz's shoulder, perilously close to the bubbling cauldrons. Almaz puts down the stirring ladle and shifts me to her hip. Reaching into her blouse, grunting with effort, she fishes out her breast. "Here it is," she says, putting it in my hands for safekeeping. I am the recipient of many gifts, but this is the first one I remember. Each time it is given to me, it is a surprise. When it is taken away, the slate is wiped clean. But here it is, warm and alive, eased out of its cloth bed, bestowed on me like a medal I don't deserve. Almaz, who hardly speaks, resumes stirring, humming a tune. It is as if the breast no more belongs to her than does her ladle. Shiva in the pram puts down his wooden truck, which his saliva has digested to a soggy pulp. It is, unlike his anklet, separable from him if need be. In the presence of that magnificent one-eyed teat, Shiva lets the truck fall to the floor. Though I have possession of the breast, stroking it, palpating it, I am also his amanuensis. A rapt Shiva spurs me on and sends silent instructions. "Throw it to me." And when I cannot, he says, "Open it and see what is inside." That too is impossible. I mold it, indent it, and watch it rebound. "Put it to your mouth," Shiva says, because this is the first means by which he knows the world. I dismiss this idea as absurd. The breast is everything Almaz is not. Laughing, vibrant, an outgoing member of our household. When I try to lift it, to examine it, that teat dwarfs my hands and spills out between my fingers. I wish to confirm how all its surfaces sweep up to the summit, the dark pap through which it breathes and sees the world. The breast comes down to my knees, or perhaps it comes down to Almaz's knees, I can't be sure. It quivers like jelly. Steam condenses on its surface, dulling its sheen. It carries the scent of crushed ginger and cumin powder from Almaz's fingers. Years later, when I first kiss a woman's breast, I become ravenous. A flash of light and a blast of crisp air announce Rosina's return. I am back in her arms, removed from the breast, which vanishes as mysteriously as it has appeared, swallowed by Almaz's blouse. In the late morning, the chill long gone and the mist burned away, we play on the lawn till our cheeks are red. Rosina feeds us. Hunger and drowsiness blend together perfectly, like the rice and curry, yogurt and bananas in our belly. It is an age of perfection, of simple appetites. After lunch, Shiva and I fall asleep, arms around each other, breathing on each other's face, heads touching. In that fugue state between wakefulness and dreaming, the song I hear is not Rosina's. It is Tisita, which Almaz sang when I held her breast. I will hear that song through all my years in Ethiopia. When I leave Addis Ababa as a young man, I will carry it with me on a cassette that has Tisita along with Aqualung. Departure or imminent death will force you to define your true tastes. During my years of exile, as the battered cassette wears out, I'll meet Ethiopians abroad. My word of greeting in our shared language is a spark, a link to a community, a network.
the phone number of Waziro, Mrs. Menon, who for a modest fee cooks injera and wat and serves you in a house if you call her the day before. The taxi driver Otto Mr. Girma, whose cousin works for Ethiopian Airlines and brings in kibe, Ethiopian butter.